you listen to this podcast, you can subscribe to The Critic magazine with the current offer of 5 issues for just £10. Head to our website, www.thecritic.co.uk, to subscribe today.
Last week, we were talking about canals in the late 18th century, and the usual way in which the transport history of the country is done is to go from canals in the 18th century to rail in the 19th century. And of course, we've covered rail. I hope you've all had a chance to listen to the programmes. And as you all know, the history of rail really does pick up in the beginning of the 19th century, when one takes the pre-existing pattern of railways along which horses pulled wagons and replaced those by the addition of locomotive power, steam, and there we are, steam and Stevenson, the new world rocketing into the future. Well, that's all true. But as so often in history, what that does is underplays the extent to which pre-existing situations were still continuing. And that's, in a sense, what I want to talk about today. We will move on probably next week, because we are not rushing this. This is an important series. We'll move on to look at the difficult days for canals. But let's start off by actually looking at the early 19th century, the age of rail, actually looking at it at the age of a continued growth in water traffic by rivers, by canals, and actually coastal traffic as well, and say that this is important. It's important not only in its own right at explaining the background of the 19th century and of 19th century changes and enabling us to contextualize rail, but it also is important because of what it more generally shows in terms of the history of the country and indeed of other countries, and that is the overlap. And overlap, in my view, is a significant factor. And by overlap, I don't mean overlap in the sense of one technology, one set of beliefs, one set of practices are redundant, but clinging on like a sort of crust that is waiting for the rigor of time to do the, as it were, the dishwasher of change. It's not that. What one is instead suggesting is that there's more than one vital and dynamic situation at play. And this is significant because all too often lazy people, i.e. most people who comment on past, present and future, use the notion of the zeitgeist, the spirit of the age or the technology of the age, and through that try and simplify and explain, both narrate and explain. And what I'm saying is you cannot explain a situation that is so complex by suggesting that there is one type that is clearly prime and significant above all else. So, what we're going to do now is we're going to actually talk about the early 19th century, first in terms of river improvement and then in canals. So let's start with rivers. I was looking into this and I found in particular the River Ribble from Preston to the Irish Sea. Preston, of course, major industrial centre. In fact, it's the town which Charles Dickens is to write about in Hard Times, as a major centre of industry and also of industrial strife. And in the case of the Ribble, due to sandbanks and a changing river channel, which was normal for, of course, most rivers in that period, it's only really in the 19th century that rivers get canalised, both of which were frequent problems, sandbanks and changing river channels, a company of merchants and townspeople, backed by the corporation, acquired parliamentary backing in 1806 in order to improve the navigation and, in fact, control it as well on the Ribble. And that's crucial because parliamentary legislation permits you to raise charges. Subsequent legislation in 1838 and 1858 created new companies and eventually in 1883 handed the task to Preston Corporation. Not a surprise here, it was a difficult challenge, difficult to make any money from or to return investment from. This costly responsibility of improvement involved stabilising and straightening the channels of the Ribble, and building walls in the estuary to restrict sand movement. You know, sand comes in, you then have to spend enormous amount of money on dredging. The task was made much more difficult by the greater size of sailing ships in the 19th century and then the introduction of iron steamers. But nevertheless, there were complaints to Parliament about the cost of the works. And indeed, it's worth bearing in mind that if you look up the Ribble navigation attempts to, you know, the attempts to improve it, you will see that far from a triumphant account of technological progress, what you actually see is cost overruns, failures to obtain outcomes, everything that we might anticipate from a modern age. And I've been out near Exeter today, and it's rather interesting. I don't think one should really talk about potholes. They've been got rid of in the sense that the road surface is gone. So you move, as it were, across a different road surface comprised of linked potholes. Anyway, there was also, for the early 19th century, much work, even more work, on canals. In part, for example, some of them were the bringing to fruition of late 19th century schemes. So, delayed in part by the need to build many locks, the Birmingham to Worcester Canal was finished in 1815. Or the Caledonian Canal, which really is more of a 19th century than a late 18th century run, 60 miles long, had 28 major locks, but it took 18 years, not seven, to build, and faced very major cost overruns. It was begun in 1804 and finished in 1822. Steam engines were used for pumping and dredging this canal. Thomas Telford's other works included the Hare Castle Tunnel on the Trent and Mersey Canal, which is 2,920 yards long, the cast iron aqueduct over the Dee on the Ellesmere Canal, joining the Mersey, the Dee and the Severn, and that was a 68-mile canal, the Birmingham and Liverpool Junction Canal, the Birmingham Canal Improvement, and the Canal Seaport Warehouse Interchange at Ellesmere Port. All of these were significant, not just to the immediate locality, but also in providing linked systems of what in effect was a transport system. And that, of course, was absent in early railways. Early railways like the Stockton and Darlington were very much unique railways that had only limited links to others, initially no links to others, but then only limited ones for a while. Successful canals could serve for different purposes. For example, the Rochdale Canal brought grain to the workforce of Lancashire, building materials to Manchester, and Lancashire cotton textiles to North Sea ports, which greatly increased coastal and export markets. Now, what's interesting is that in Parliament, and parliamentary debates for the 19th century are very instructive to read. When you have parliamentary debates, you see debates about the respective merits or alleged merits and alleged defects of both canals and railways. So in 1834, the parliamentary bill for the construction of the Great Western Railway was in committee stage, and it's committees of the House that provide the most instructive debates, because you tend to have the discussion by those members of Parliament that are experts. And some of the strongest opposition to the GWR came from the Kennet and Avon Canal, which you can still see at a long part of the GWR route. The GWR directors lined up a number of speakers to complain about canal transport. So Samuel Provis, formerly a freight carrier by canal between London and Bristol, told the committee that the fastest trip between the two cities was around 3 days by canal. But the frequent seasonal delays, shortages of water in the summer, winter floods and frosts meant that the journey could take 2 to 3 weeks or longer. Richard Mills, a barge master from Reading, told MPs that the longest frost he had encountered had stopped passage for 9 weeks. Now, these were arguments that were pertinent. But of course, once you've got the canal in place, the investment is there. Whereas with the railway, you're being asked to produce a new investment, and therefore you need speculation. There is to be speculation, but at that stage, that requires a much more significant profit anticipation than the existing, what in a sense are running costs of the canals. The running costs of canals were more modest. And canals continued. So the Grand Western Canal, for which a parliamentary act was passed in 1796, was planned from Topsham, where the Ex meets the sea. Where the Ex meets the estuary is a fairer remark, to Taunton, providing a route onto the Bristol Channel. So this, in other words, was going to link the Bristol Channel and access, therefore, to Bristol and South Wales to the Ex just short of the English Channel, in providing a route that was actually quite significant in terms of avoiding the problems of rounding Cornwall. In reality, that one was one that was hit by the railway. Only the section from Tiverton on was built, and the opening of the Bristol and Exeter Railway in 1844 superseded this canal route. And if you look at canals in Devon, many of them were hit hard by railways, but also by the problems encountered by canals, and it also ought to be mentioned by the hill terrain of so much of the southwest, and by the fact that there was less industrial demand and therefore a lower profit margin. To meet the competition from rail, canal companies drastically cut their tolls in 1840. They hadn't really needed to do that prior to that. And I think that's fair to say that that is the major change that registers the real challenge at that point. This was of value to freight shippers, but not passengers. The use of steam tugs instead of horses speeded up, in the meantime, canal transport. So many of the arguments made in Parliament in 1834 by the GWR against canals were less valid because steam power was now actually also being used by river and canal traffic. Indeed, the Gloucester Journal noted on the 9th of April 1836, "The formation of a steamboat company for the purpose of facilitating the passage of vessels bound to or from this port is a matter of such paramount importance to the mercantile classes connected with Gloucester that we feel it is only necessary to direct attention to an advertisement which appears in an adjoining column." In other words, if you read the newspaper, you will see that there's an advertisement of the news service and the newspaper is drawing attention to the advertisement. The two, of course, are backed by the same interests. Steamboats were used on rivers to transport passengers or freight, for example, on the River Weir in the northeast. And from 1827, a steamboat began operation on the Severn ferry crossing from Orse to Beachley, another one being added in 1832. Although across that part of the Severn, sailing boats also continued to be employed. It's not until the Severn Railway Bridge is built in 1879 and the Severn Tunnel follows in 1886, it's not then until then that really the steamboat and sailing crossings of the Severn estuary really collapse. And I think that's instructive because 1879 and even more 1886, so that's the tunnel you go under at the present moment if you go from Bristol to Cardiff. You know, that's considerably different from dating the demise of water transport to the beginning of the 19th century. Steam also, of course, played a role at sea, so that there was, you know, steamships from Liverpool playing a major role from the early 19th century on the Dublin route, actually providing a quick service. And I think it's worth bearing in mind that it's still the case that the speeds now on the ferries across the Irish Sea are not really all that different from the 19th century speeds. Now, there were problems of course, for steamships. And indeed, partly because of these problems, risk factors and therefore insurance costs were lower for rail, although a lot of early railways did have accidents, of course, Charles Dickens famously being involved in one. But for long, it's the case that steamships had the problems of applying steam technology were compounded by those of providing sufficient coal, and as well as that, the extent to which, with low initial efficiency of steam engines, you had to carry coal, which reduced the space available to transport cargo. It's worth bearing in mind that low initial efficiency of steam engines also affected rail. As a result, of course, steamships still carried sails, which you couldn't actually do with railways. There was also a lack of sufficient coaling stations and there of cargo space for coal. Whilst the impact of the weather lessened the security of timetables for steamship travel compared to that of a railway. Nevertheless, rather than assuming that these factors, as it were a stationary situation, which with rail therefore obviously doing better, it's worth bearing in mind, first of all, that steamships offered a degree of safety and predictability and speed that was greater than that of sailing ships on crossing waters like the Irish Sea, or for that matter, towed barges on rivers or canals. Secondly, it's worth bearing in mind that steam engines improved, that this benefited, of course, railways. You know, by the early 20th century, you can get a rail locomotive, City of Truro famously, going at over 100 miles an hour. I think that was on the Yeovil stretch. I think it's 1904, but my memory is not very good these days. But also, of course, you get steam engines at sea, and the high-pressure steam engine and the increase in efficient power it offers was very much to the benefit of steam transport at sea by the late 19th century. Separate to that, shipping continued to benefit from the coastal nature of much of the British population and economy, much more so than today. So in the case of the Bristol Channel, you see not just that there are far more people living in South Wales than Central Wales, and far more people living along, let's say, the coast of North Devon, the nearby coast of Somerset, than are living 20 miles south of there. But you also see as a result of that, that you get shipping improving in the Bristol Channel. So the first packets from Bristol to Ilfracombe began in 1824, and a more regular service from Swansea began in 1826. And what you've got is an enormous amount of coastal traffic is still going on using the old staples of coal and grain, and also such basics as timber and also limestone for processing into fertilizer. So all of those remain pertinent. And listeners who may have also listened to our discussions on roads will know that also that there is considerable improvement in turnpikes in the early 19th century, as well as in road bridges. And what this does is it doesn't mean that we shouldn't pay attention to railways. What it means is that we need to be aware that there were speculative challenges facing rail, in part as a matter of trying to cope with the relative efficiencies of the competition. And what that helps to do is ensure that certain lines, certain connections are much more pertinent for railways than others. And of course, it's no accident that railways radiate out, you know, classically from London or Birmingham or Manchester, but railways are much less a matter of following coastline. There are railways that follow coastlines. You can think, for example, of the line between Berwick and Edinburgh, or the line between Exeter and Newton, well, Dawlish, and then the estuary on to Newton Abbot. But I think it's worth bearing in mind that on the whole, these coastal links were not particularly great by railway, and it takes a while before them to improve. I mean, if you're looking at the southwest, for example, the railway doesn't reach Ilfracombe and Sidmouth until 1874. It doesn't reach Budley Salterton until 1897. It doesn't reach Linton until 1898. And it doesn't reach Westward Ho until 1901. And as a result of that, paddle steamers were all much more important along those coastlines than railways for a long period of time. And of course, with the paddle steamers, you get piers and quays. Similarly, in Brixham, the branch line to Brixham, which was authorised by Parliament in 1864, doesn't open until 1868. And that therefore means that Brixham landed fish can then move by train, but it's worth bearing in mind that that's, as I said, 1868. Prior to that, it's not really the case that you have got an ability to move that other than by road or sea. Linked to this is the extent to which, as well, rail was important in part as a feeder to maritime trade. And that again tends to be forgotten. I mean, if you want to think of the 19th century in terms of the grandeur of Paddington or St. Pancras and comparable stations elsewhere, you know, marvellous station at Newcastle and the one at York, for example, that's fine. They're all marvellous. It's well thinking about. But it's also worth bearing in mind the enormous docks that go up in that period. In places like Hull, I think it's the King George V at the end, but before that, there are a whole host of them. Or in London, the Poplar Dock in 1852, the Royal Victoria in 55, the Millwall in 68, the Royal Albert in 1880, and the Tilbury in 1886. And these all indicate the continued importance of water transport. Indeed, dating from 1915, the splendour of the Port of London Authority building, which you can still see, captured the significance in trade. And in London, as elsewhere, the factories were located near the quayside. The efficiency of coastal and other shipping improved. By 1900, over 90% of all registered tonnage was steam-powered, sail being much reduced in significance and essentially local. And in 1884, the first efficient steam turbine was developed by Charles Parsons. And if you look at the water transport, you should see rail in many senses is symbiotic with that. So 1893, Britain imported 3.9 million animal carcasses. By 1909, about 80% of the bread consumed was made with imported wheat. All of that comes by sea. Rail then serves to distribute much of it, although some of it is distributed in a sense by ships actually landing it in places other than London. But what it does do is that you should see rail not as superseding other methods, but as being part of them. You know, now it's true that coastal travel was shadowed by railways, but the victory was often hard fought and took time. So let's take the movement of coal. In 1855, 3 million tons of coal was still moved by sea to London, only 1.2 million by rail. Only in 1869 was coal brought by sea matched by that moved by rail. Principally, this is coal from the northeast of England and to London. And in 1879, although 6.6 million tonnes were transported to London by rail, some 3.5 million still entered the Thames by sea, and coastal shipping from the Tyne was still indeed a major means of coal movement into the 1960s. coastal shipping remained important for other commodities, such as grain or for pool, for example, clay. Nevertheless, it's true that the relative role of such shipping markedly declined from certainly the 1870s, while the hinterlands of lesser ports contracted. And more generally, the decline of coastal shipping meant a fall in the economic impact of the sea. So the sea remains important. And, you know, you'd be a fool to ignore that if you're looking at Glasgow or Liverpool or London or Aberdeen or Hull. The sea remained, Southampton, the sea remained astonishingly important for people entering and leave and freight entering and leaving the country. I think I'm right in saying that it's about 1959 is when more people go in by air to Britain than go in by sea. And of course, still to this day, more goods are shipped in than by sea than by air, or through the Channel Tunnel for that matter. But it's worth bearing in mind that coastal shipping diminishes in significance. Canals and railways remained important, but they were overshadowed by rail. Now, not all canals were in difficulties. And what I want to do is to mention a little bit about that. Then Graham and I will chat a bit, and then we're going to continue next time. So let's start off by saying that in 1853, that's, you know, what there's already rail services to a lot of places, but in 1853, the Oxford Canal Company was able to give its staff a 20% wage rise and to declare an 11.5% dividend. Those figures are made much more impressive if you realise how low inflation was in that period. And at that stage, the Buckinghamshire Railway did not appear to be serious competition to the Oxford Canal Company. The Canal Company was a large staff with wharfingers responsible for collecting canal dues, lock keepers, labourers and craftsmen. And the company in mid-century developed a number of quarries to provide paving for towpaths and wharfs, which is indeed an instance of the more general tendency of transport concerns to provide for their own needs as builders, operators and employers. Indeed, they were often the major enterprises in particular centres and even as sectors across those centres. And that's where I'd like to close at this point. So in other words, we've still got a buoyant and dynamic canal system at this section in mid-century. And we want to go on and look at what happened to that later in the century next time.
Thank you very much, Jeremy. Many different aspects to ponder in what you've said. I want to start by asking a question about the development of steam technology, the way in which steamboats and steamships develop at roughly the same time as steam trains, a little bit after, I think. You'll correct me on that. But there's obviously a relationship between technological developments on rail and on sea with steam. On canals that go on inland canals, how quickly did steam technology on the boats going up the canals and navigable inland rivers take over from having canal boats being pulled by horses on the towpath?
Right. Well, actually, our steam technology at sea or on rivers was not that slow. Robert Fulton's ship, what is it called, Democlus or something like that, is in New York Harbour using steam in 1815. And HMS Diana goes up the Irrawaddy in the, I think, 400 miles in the first Anglo-Burmese War. And I think that's 1824. And the Royal Navy has, you know, steamships. They're not big ships. But they have steamships from several years before that. So I think what you should really think of is that it does take time and investment to, as it were, determine whether you can retrofit new technology to existing ships or whether you're actually going to have to build new ships. And if you do, will they need different specifications, in particular a different draft? And if so, does that require modifications? And there is also issues that have to be addressed, such as the availability of coal, and also the, as indeed with trains, what it's going to be like going through a long tunnel, and some of these tunnels are very long, if you're producing the steam, because you've got to bear in mind that steam efficiency is lower, so that the steam was much more granular with much more coal dust in it and much more disagreeable is being polite. But having said all that, the investment is there, and I think it's fair to say that those areas where people think they can return money gain on the investment, there is a movement to steam quite rapidly. But obviously, the cost does not seem to be sensible to much of the network, not least those aspects of the network that are not, as it were, fulfilling the hopes of the boosters that underlie that. Now, there's an obvious instance of this later. If you think about it, what the background to the Beeching cuts in many respects was the issues about of costing investment and return on both capital and operating expenditure of the move from steam to diesel in the 1950s and 1960s, with it being not regarded necessarily as economic to invest in diesel for part of the network. Now, one has to be careful here. There were other factors involved. But I think it's fair to say that although by 1840 and even more 1850, it was very clear that some canals were not economic. And indeed, that had been clear earlier on for some reasons. I mean, in part, because it's often once only when you build a canal that you discover some of the operating engineering issues, classically to do with water supply and with water retention, both of which are issues in canals. But I think it's worth saying that that this costing element would have been pertinent even if there hadn't been railways. In other words, the absence of an adequate return on capital is always going to be an issue for a system. And in, you know, I was making a comment earlier about potholes and roads. You could argue that the failure to provide an adequate road surface is bound up at the present moment. I mean, there are all sorts of issues of how cost is allocated and whether government, local or national, is an adequate basis for evaluating return on capital. But you could argue that the proliferation of potholes is an aspect of a similar process today with road transport. After all, you will tend to ensure that potholes don't become too large on motorways and major trunk roads, but much of the system seems to have been abandoned.
These early steamboats, they are all paddle steamers, or how does the technology evolve? I have in my mind, as we had in the United States and
No, they're not as big. They're not as big as
wide kind of Mississippi style paddle steamers.
No,
They went into
they're not
really.
those. They are not like that. If you're thinking about those, you should be thinking about more the kind of pleasure steamers of the later 19th century that serve some of the coastal resorts. No, the technology of a screw is the one that's most pertinent. So you have the screw at the back of the ship turning round, and you have a relatively simple steam engine on the ship. And again, bear in mind the steam engines that were on trains in that period were relatively simple. If you want to actually see a steam engine on a train of that period and actually go on one, a very good outing is to go to Beamish in County Durham, where I've been on one of the steam engines there. I mean, as it moved and pulled a small train. And I think I'm right that they certainly, when I was there, they had two steam engines that were working, both of which were based on early 19th century models. These are, shall we say, a world away from the notion of a steam engine that you would have in 1900, still more in 1935. So you've got relatively simple working parts, you've got low fuel efficiency, but you've got low cost and relatively easy maintenance issues. There's also, of course, the danger of fire, which is another aspect. If for those listeners who are of a certain age, or indeed actually anybody with the sense of fun, you may recall that Toad ends up on a barge in Wind in the Willows, and the barge is it a canal or is it a canalized river? I'm not certain. I think it's a canal. You know, it's still playing a role. But I'm just trying to think. I think if there's a horse towing it, but I can't remember whether that's
there is
true.
There is a horse towing it when he's on the canal boat with the washer, or he's pretending to be a washerwoman.
Yeah, he's pretending to be a washerwoman. Yeah. Yes, actually, in many senses, it is so memorable and so funny. It's a wonderful work.
Yes, it is. Well, unfortunately, we're out of time. I very much enjoyed hearing about maritime and canal traffic in the age of steam. And we will continue with this series next time. But for now, Professor Jeremy Black, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.
If you've enjoyed listening to this podcast, why not subscribe to have the magazine delivered to your door? Subscribe today with the current offer of 5 issues for £10 by heading to our website www.thecritic.co.uk.